This is Milt Rosenberg, and we welcome you to the podcast of the same name. My guest on this occasion is Robert Merry, whom many will remember was for quite a while the editor of the Congressional Quarterly. These days, Robert, you serve as the political editor of the magazine National Interest. Is that right?
That is correct, and I'm also writing books, so I'm combining those two things.
Yes, and the last one you wrote is what we're going to be discussing, or rather the many issues addressed in that book we will be discussing today. It is titled, Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. You have, in fact, generated a list of the best and the worst of American presidents. What are your basic criteria for defining the adequacy or the inferiority or superiority of presidential performance?
Well, the great presidents, I think, fit three criteria that I put forward. One is that they're presidents who were appreciated during their time by the electorate, and the best way of determining that is, were they two-term presidents succeeded by their own party? That's not very easy to do. There aren't that many presidents who managed to pull that off. Secondly, what do the historians say? That's history's judgment. There's these series of polls and surveys that have been conducted since 1948 when Arthur Schlesinger Sr. of Harvard University first sort of perpetrated this concept. And then thirdly, for the greats, I say that they had to really change the political landscape at a time when that was needed and set the country on a new direction. And that's not easy to do either. So the greats are pretty easy to figure out. The fools and knaves at the bottom of the list, we could have sort of endless discussion and sometimes debate about that. Normally they're people who either committed a failure of omission or failure of commission. Let me explain briefly what that is. A failure of omission is inheriting a crisis and not being able to handle the crisis. A good example of that would be James Buchanan, who preceded Lincoln. James Buchanan was a man of low character, and he only cared about himself, and consequently, he simply was not positioned, he wasn't equipped to deal with the terrible crisis that was brewing.
Let me quickly interpose with a question. Suppose that the sequence had been reversed. Suppose Lincoln was a few years older than he really was, and that he was elected to that presidential term, which would have been 4 years before 1860. Thus, the election year would have been 1856, I assume.
Correct.
If Lincoln had been president instead of Buchanan, would we have avoided the Civil War?
Well, that's hard to say. I do believe that Lincoln was a man. I mean, he was truly one of the great presidents. The polls, the historical polls, have him at number one almost universally, sometimes George Washington. But he was a man of immense political genius, and I think he would have been able to try to figure out, and probably successfully, what to do about the situation that existed in 1857 when he took office, just as he ultimately did in a much more crisis-prone period in 1861.
You have given us evaluations on the basis of those criteria you just reviewed, that the man should have been elected and reelected, and then the candidate representing his same party should have been his successor. That is a kind of basic index of having been much appreciated because much good has been done. Isn't it conceivable, though, that somebody might meet those criteria, get elected once, get elected twice, and then his successor his elected successor be of the same party as was he? Couldn't that happen to somebody who was a bad president, but who hornswoggled the public, who essentially got away with it because he maintained high popularity even though his performance was poor?
Well, if you think that the electorate is foolish and that it doesn't really come together in any kind of judgment of value, then you might see that as the way things could work or has worked. But I don't believe that. I believe that there's a collective judgment in the electorate, sometimes even a collective wisdom. And if you look at the two-term presidents succeeded by their own party, almost always, except in sort of aberrational times, you almost always get somebody who number one, was appreciated by the voters contemporaneously, but then also is held highly by the historians as well. Not always immediately, because sometimes the passions of the moment obscure that, but ultimately that's the case. In the 20th century, bear in mind that there are only two presidents who have been elected twice and succeeded by their own party. They're partial term examples, which we can get to, but the only two presidents who were elected twice and succeeded by their own party were Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan. I happen to believe that the two of them, one the most liberal president of the century, one the most conservative, I believe that they're the greatest presidents of the 20th century.
Actually, FDR more than meets your criterion of a third successful election, in that he ran for a third term and won that one as well.
And a fourth term.
And a fourth term, which ended just a month or two after his induction for the fourth term.
Right.
But what do you make of that the two who meet those statistical requirements are of quite opposite orientation and of opposite intention?
Well, the country needs different things at different times.
Uh-huh.
And what the important thing is that it worked. It's possible that Roosevelt could have moved America out of the Great Depression with a more conservative approach. Maybe not, we'll never know, but nevertheless, whether he could or not, it had to work. And when you look at what he accomplished, he had, Roosevelt, he had like 7% growth from a very, very low base. The GDP had just plummeted during Hoover's administration, but 7% growth for almost 4 years is quite a remarkable achievement. And the American people basically said, well, we don't think we're going to get anything better from the opposition. He's getting us out of the depression, not quickly, maybe not quickly enough, but he's doing it. Now, what happened in his second term is the first 2 years, he got kind of nervous about inflation and he raised taxes, and then he brought in Social Security, which also raised taxes. And he had a rather significant sort of recession within the depression on his hands. And if he hadn't in the last 2 years of his second term turned that around, he wouldn't have been a four-term president.
When you take the three election criteria or the three election standard as a way of assessing or measuring or indexing a greatness of performance as president, apparently there are only about six or seven people who meet that standard. They are Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, and the two Roosevelts, Theodore and Franklin D. No one else has managed to win two elections and then be followed by a successor from the same party.
Well, that's not quite right, Milt. There's eight. There are eight presidents.
Oh. Who's the one I left out?
You left out Reagan. I'm drawing a blank right now, but let me say there's also partial term presidents, and if you include the partial term presidents such as Teddy Roosevelt, who inherited the office, was elected in his own right, and then succeeded by his own party, or Calvin Coolidge, then we have 12.
Mm-hmm.
So you can count 8 or you can count 12, and that's out of 44 presidents, it shows that that's not the easiest thing to accomplish. But bear in mind, I'm not saying this is the only criterion for determining presidential greatness. This is only one.
It is the electoral index, as it were.
That's the electoral index out of the three criteria that I put forth.
Interesting that Coolidge then gets in as well. Generally, there's been a kind of an amused condescension towards Coolidge for much of the time that has elapsed since his presidency. Only quite recently have there been a few biographies which have given us a new appreciation of Coolidge as a wise and effective president. What's your own view of Coolidge's actual achievements or failure of achievement?
I think he's been underrated, and he's been underrated by the historians who tend to be more activists because they tend to be more liberal people in the academic realm. And so they have tended to not credit Coolidge with the accomplishments of his time in office. And my own view is that he presided over robust economic growth. He handled foreign policy, not in a time of great crisis or even great challenge, but nevertheless handled it successfully. He reduced the amount of, along with Hardy, whose presidency he inherited, he reduced the amount of sort of civic strife that was going on in terms of labor unrest, et cetera. So it's hard to say that Coolidge was a failure or even close to a failure. I'd say that he was a moderately successful president.
You recently did an article in which you named the worst presidents. What was it? Were they 10? I believe you had 10 enumerated.
Five.
Five only. Who were the five worst?
Well, in my judgment, the worst president is James Buchanan, whom I've already mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, and James Buchanan, let me just digress about a little bit on this guy. Talk about low character. He lied on the, upon taking office, he lied to the American people. In his inaugural address, he said this pending Dred Scott decision, which everyone knew was going to be, you know, a rock thrown into an anthill. He said that whatever the decision was, he would abide by it. Well, he wasn't supposed to know, but he knew what the decision was because he had actually tried to find out and did know what the decision was. So here he was dissembling to the American people in the very moment of his taking office. So he was a terrible president. Franklin Pierce, also during that time, was a failure of omission. He wasn't able to handle the brewing crisis that was engulfing the country. I then include George W. Bush, because I believe that this is a failure of commission. He took us into the Middle East in a way that I think has totally destabilized the Middle East in ways that we're going to be paying for a very, very long time. And he presided over real financial incontinence in terms of his fiscal policies. And we're going to be paying for that for a significant period of time. I include Woodrow Wilson.
Really?
Wilson is highly regarded by the historians. He's usually up there in 12, sometimes even a little bit higher. And his first term was a moderate success, which is, in my view, why he was reelected. But his second term was a abject failure. He got us into a war. He in doing so, he destroyed the economy. He trampled all over civil liberties. American people couldn't wait to get rid of the Democratic Party after Wilson's fourth term.
He said, I quote, "We are citizens of the world. The tragedy of our times is that we do not know this." And indeed, Wilsonianism was a strong push toward opening up to the world and indeed setting the world aright. Remember, he justified World War I, or our entry into it, as the war that would end all wars. He seems to have had international concerns very much on his mind.
Oh, more so than any national concerns. In fact, to be a Wilsonian, to be a true Wilsonian, you have to believe that American self-interest is something that you don't really feel very comfortable with, whereas the interest of all humanity, which is an abstraction that you really can't deal with, is something that gives him and his followers and his acolytes and his subsequent Wilsonians a warm feeling. And he even took great pride in the fact that when he took America into World War I, he said, we have no national stake in this. We're not doing this because of any American national interest. Well, my own personal view on that is that the presidents ought not to send American young men and now young women into harm's way unless there is a national interest involved.
You fault George W. Bush for having done just that in Iraq. But at the time, was there not a considerable belief on the part of his advisors and from those who gathered the intelligence material that weapons of mass destruction were indeed available to Saddam Hussein and that he had intentions to use them? And he had indeed already shown his hand as an aggressor to George W. Bush's father, because when George H.W. Was president, we had the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait.
We did. And Saddam Hussein was an evil man. He's an abject international jerk, if you will. But he did not really pose a significant threat to the United States of America. He was not aligned with, he was a thug. Thugs are motivated by two things, just like the mafia, greed and fear. And they know how to play greed and fear. The enemy of the United States after 9/11 was Islamic fundamentalism. He was not an Islamic fundamentalist. And anybody who sort of studied it even a bit, in my view, would have been able to know that. So I don't think it's true that there was intelligence that said there were weapons of mass destruction, but the fact is there wasn't. So that was foolhardy and reckless to send the country into a war based on a supposition that turns out to be utterly false.
That rather reminds me, you know, of one of the major themes in the election campaign of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, when he told the country that we had suffered a tremendous missile gaffe. The Soviets were vastly ahead of us in nuclear-tipped missiles, and unless he were elected, they would be able to essentially have their way with us because of their military superiority. When, in fact, it was the case, and he knew it to be the case, that we had missile superiority over the Soviet Union at that time.
I don't think that Kennedy knew it. Eisenhower knew it because we had the U-2, and it drove Eisenhower crazy. But I wrote a book some years ago on Joe and Stuart Alsop, the famous post-war columnist, famous at the time, not so famous today, but who were extremely influential in all of this. And Joe Alsop was a particularly great exponent and promoter of the idea that a missile gap was emerging, and he was very close to Kennedy, both before and after Kennedy became president, and it fed Kennedy a lot of these ideas in terms of how to put it together in senatorial speeches, et cetera. I think that was, that was not a greatest moment for John F. Kennedy when he was essentially perpetrating a myth to the American people. But
we would prefer honesty from our presidents, but that is never fully possible, is it? One of the strangest and most naively uttered assurances given to the American people, perhaps, or maybe it was totally ingenuous when he uttered it, came from Jimmy Carter, who in his election campaign said, "There's one thing I will promise you, I will never lie to you." Can any president get through a term without telling some lies?
Well, there are times when you need to basically change the subject or get out of a situation where it's just not propitious and it's not responsible to tell the American people certain things that are very, very delicate and sensitive at a given time. And getting out of that kind of a situation sometimes requires some dissembling. And so it's probably not wise for Jimmy Carter to say, "I'll never lie to you." He maybe could have found a better way of expressing it.
The title of your book, of course, as you well remember, your most recent book, is Where They Stand, The American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians. That book by Robert Merry was published last year, I believe, by Simon & Schuster, and should be readily available wherever they sell real books. I want to take you on a sort of an excursion of the presidents, the post-Roosevelt presidents. That is, we start with Truman and take it from there. Let me feed you each name in order of election and get your evaluation. Tell me how one would evaluate their presidencies and what the data show with regard to popular response, and for that matter, response by historians and others who stand by to do the more lasting evaluations. So, first up, Harry Truman.
Well, I think that all historians agree that Harry Truman's first term was heroic. What he accomplished and what he did in terms of getting us from a wartime footing to a peacetime footing, both economically and then standing up to the Soviets when they had 1.3 million troops on the doorstep of Europe, was quite remarkable. And how he did it, the decision-making, the boldness, was, as I say, heroic. I have to say that my view is that his second term was rather mediocre, and there was a lot of sort of petty scandals involving some of his cronies that he put into government positions that he shouldn't have. The economy sputtered for a good part of his second term. He got us into a war that he couldn't control and couldn't get out of in Korea, which is a poisonous thing for any president to do. And so it was inevitable, in my view, getting to my view about how this works, presidential elections being largely referendums on the incumbent, that the country was going to turn to the Republican Party, and Truman was not going to be invited to retain the nomination, and that's what happened.
But overall, he doesn't quite make it as one of the greats on your list, at least.
No, but he's a near great because his first term was so heroic that it really cancels out some of the unfortunate stuff that happened in his second term.
Here is something curious. I wonder if you would agree that this happened this way. When he left office, he was held in rather low regard, and it was thought that he was sort of a failed president and let him go back to Missouri and so on. These days, if you ask people, and even if you ask historians, you get a much higher evaluation. And I really have the impression that one book really began to reverse our judgment about him. And that was, of course, David McCullough's book, titled quite simply, Truman. What do you think?
Well, McCullough's book had a big impact in terms of how the American people viewed Truman. But within the academy and among historians, his stock had been rising significantly for a good 20 years before that. And in fact, it's a little bit of a misconception that it's clear that Truman was held in very low regard by the American people after his second term.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I tend to look at these terms as individual, look at these presidencies in terms of individual terms. But nevertheless, the historians held him up at a pretty high level almost from the beginning, and he managed to retain that and still is. He's clearly in the near great category among historians.
Next up in line, Truman's successor, General Dwight David Eisenhower.
Well, when the first academic poll took place after Eisenhower relinquished the presidency, this was in 1962, these academics, who are largely liberal and activist-minded in terms of what a president should be and do, had him in sort of maybe just barely below the mediocre level. I mean, he was they didn't have any high regard for him at all. And Clinton Rossiter, the famous historian, presidential historian at Cornell, basically said he kind of lingered one term too long in a heroic age. He was a kind of a stand pat kind of a guy. But history has taken a much different view of Eisenhower, and I think the American people do too. He was much more clever and much more in command than people understood at the time. And part of that was because he didn't care how they judged him, and so he wasn't trying to project an image. He was just trying to get the right decisions made. And largely he did. And if you think about Eisenhower, I mean, we pretty much have to go back to Eisenhower to find somebody who was as cautious about, you know, he certainly was not afraid to use military force or to threaten military force. And his massive retaliation doctrine was something that was very bold, but it was a gamble. And he was very wise and measured in terms of getting troops into harm's way, because he understood that in the new era, the prospects were just too high of getting yourself mired into a kind of a quagmire. And that's what happened subsequently in Vietnam, which Eisenhower kept us out of.
We always have public images of these people which tend to focus on one or two things. For example, later on, and we'll come to him later, when Gerry Ford was president, they laughed over the fact that he stumbled and fell a great deal, which had virtually nothing, it wasn't particularly true, and had nothing to do with his presidency. For Eisenhower, the common received idea, much elaborated by journalistic commentators, I suppose, was that he had very jumbled syntax and couldn't hold an ordinary press conference without making a bit of a fool of himself.
Yeah, and then I think some subsequent scholars have sort of studied these situations and put it together in terms of how he spoke and the sort of the fog that he emitted over an issue that he didn't want to deal with.
That it was a tactic, actually.
And didn't really care that people thought he was looking like a dunce, when in fact he accomplished what he wanted to accomplish, and maybe in the way that Jimmy Carter, you know, should have thought about. By just not going there and just basically throwing out this sort of this ink of a lack of a real articulation. I mean, he famously said, for example, and this is not atypical of Ike, we have a long row to hoe to keep our heads above water. I mean, mixing metaphors like that was kind of an Ikeism.
Yeah. Somehow that reminds me of a fellow I interviewed once years ago who did a book about Washington's rules. He said one basic rule was for elected officials of one sort or another was, or appointed officials, was when in doubt, mumble.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, we've got that with Eisenhower. When in doubt or when in a hard spot, confuse them.
Yes, yeah.
On to his successor, the young John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
I argue in my book that we really are not in a very good position to assess the Kennedy presidency. If you believe that the best way of looking at him is in terms of individual terms, his first term did not look like it was emerging as a great success. But on the other hand, he still had another year to turn things around. And so we can't know what his first term record ultimately would be that the American people were going to be judging in the campaign year of 1964. So I tend to think that he had elements of greatness. He had the look of greatness about him, but you can't say he was great because he never had an opportunity to really show that.
Well, the one moment of maximum challenge was, I suppose, the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And he showed greatness there, no doubt about it.
Chatted with a fellow, I'm rocking on his name now, who was a very close associate of his, who assured me that if he had not been assassinated right after his second election, after his re-election, he would have withdrawn the 17,000 advisors, military advisors that we had in Vietnam. We would never have gone into the Vietnam War if Kennedy had lived and Johnson had not succeeded him. So said Kenny O'Donnell. That's who told me that.
Well, Kenny O'Donnell's daughter, Helen, was my secretary once years ago.
Oh, really?
I like the O'Donnell family. I think that's a total canard, however.
Really?
We don't know, number one, we don't know what Kenny would have done, and the evidence is very mixed on that. But secondly, it was on his watch that the Vietnamese leader, Diem, was assassinated and killed, and the coup had taken place, which we sanctioned. We didn't sanction the killing of him, but we sanctioned the coup. And Kennedy, you may recall, became ashen-faced and had to almost rush out of a meeting with some of his top advisors when he got the word because he was so shaken by it. And he had reason to be shaken by it because when, you know, we sanction a coup and it ends up killing leaders, foreign leaders, then the United States ends up with a great deal of responsibility in that country. And I don't think that Kennedy was going to be in a position to basically say, well, sorry, guys, it didn't work out the way we wanted, so we're just going to leave you to the mercy of communism. That was not a political option in 1964, 1965.
Of course, his successor directly after the assassination, inducted into the presidency that same afternoon down in Dallas, was Lyndon Baines Johnson. Robert Caro is now working, I think, on his fourth or maybe his fifth volume in his monumental biography of Johnson. What would you like Caro to say? What evaluation would you think is appropriate?
Well, I mean, Caro has found his voice very, very nicely, I have to say, and I don't have any advice for him on that, but I will say this. Johnson poses an interesting question, which we're going to get to with another president shortly here, and that is, how do you assess the historical record of a president who had great accomplishments, but then in one area or another handled himself so abjectly that he essentially destroyed his own presidency? And that's what Lyndon Johnson did with Vietnam, even though I believe that it wasn't going to be very easy to find a way out of that thicket or through that thicket. Nevertheless, that was his job, and he failed. And as a failure, he essentially destroyed his presidency, and he decided not to run again because he was going to get annihilated in the primaries.
Of course, there are his conservative critics, and there are even a few conservative historians who would say this, that his other great achievements on the domestic front were almost equally defective, particularly his so-called war on poverty, which only enhanced or expanded poverty, and increased governmental intervention into the management of human lives, something which has proceeded well apace down to the present moment.
I think that's a reasonable proposition, and certainly reasonable to put into the American debate, the American historical debate. But in terms of dealing with the ongoing and sort of lingering civil rights problems of America, you have to say that, and I think there's a very strong consensus across the spectrum these days, that what Lyndon Johnson accomplished there had to be done, and he did it in a way that was very bold and very forceful. He knew at the time that he was going to essentially pull the South away from the Democratic Party, which is what happened, and he knew there was a significant price to be paid. So I think that you have to give him credit as being courageous when he did that. But Vietnam destroyed him, and so there you are. You can look at it and say, well, he did have some accomplishments, but you really can't say the president is successful when he destroys his own presidency.
And then we come to Richard Milhouse Nixon, who had been Eisenhower's vice president, failed in his first run for the presidency, lost to Kennedy, but then succeeds Johnson. Our most Hamlet-like president, perhaps, at least our most troubled and unhappy president, one tends to think, though maybe everything would have worked out quite differently but for the dreadful scandal that he didn't cause but then blundered as he attempted to handle it. Watergate, of course, is what I'm referring to. So how do we evaluate Richard Nixon?
Well, the point I was making with Lyndon Johnson is made in spades with Richard Nixon, because he who was absolutely brilliant. I have to say that I don't necessarily agree with everything, and he posed himself as a conservative when, in fact, he had a lot of initiatives that were very much along the liberal lines, and he got no credit from liberals who despised him almost on general principles. But here's a man who truly destroyed his own presidency with foolish approaches to a crisis that emerged, and it brought him down. And yet the overture to China, the transformation of the balance of power in Asia, which had led to a huge amount of stability that the world enjoyed for decades until it's beginning to get unraveled right now. What he did in terms of getting us out of Vietnam in probably the greatest military retreat, certainly in the history of the American Republic, which is a very, very delicate and difficult military operation, while at the same time keeping at bay the forces that were attempting to bring him down domestically in the streets. So that first term of his, leaving aside Watergate and leaving aside all the room for debates about this or that, was really a very, very successful presidency, and American people rewarded him with a landslide re-election. But Watergate destroyed it all, and so there you are.
It's interesting that he, more than most former presidents, seems to have undertaken to remain a major observer, commentator, and advisor on just about all national issues, both national and international, during his post-presidential years. I think he did about three or four books during that period and would often be sneaked into the White House through the back door. The personal drama of Richard Nixon, the only man who could wake up in the morning, rub the sleep out of his eyes, and then remember, oh, my God, I'm the only man who ever had to resign the American presidency, that personal drama remains really rather touching.
It is. It's Shakespearean in its power, isn't it?
Still, he had his time in the sun. Is the evaluation of Nixon changing in the years since his presidency?
Not really. He's getting credit for this and that, various things that he accomplished, particularly the China initiative, and I don't think he gets sufficient credit for the delicate operation that he executed to remove us from a terrible war, which he was not responsible for. And by the way, I will note, unlike our current president, who in his first term was constantly referring to the problems he inherited. Richard Nixon never uttered a word suggesting that it's all Lyndon Johnson's fault or my predecessor left me with a mess that I'm struggling with. He never did that. And I think that's a measure of, and that's certainly a reflection of elements of character. We know that the man lacked character in some crucial respects and it failed him at crucial moments. But nevertheless, I give him a lot of credit for that.
When we come to Gerry Ford, we come to not the first vice president to succeed to the presidency because, in this case, of the resignation of the president, but we've come to the man who ascended to the presidency from the position of being the only non-elected vice president in our history.
Correct. Gerry Ford was the caretaker president. He was not going to be anything else because the American people were not going to reward the Republican Party with retention in the White House after a term like the 1973 to 1977 term. But he, I have to say, was a very solid and I think very responsible caretaker president. He got us through a terrible time. I think his most controversial decision was probably the pardon. I happen to believe it was the right decision and spared the country an awful lot of turmoil and animosity and acidic warfare internally. And so I think that we all owe Gerry Ford a vote of gratitude. But he never really had an opportunity to show any kind of greatness, nor do I believe that he probably would have, even if he had had such an opportunity.
And then, of course, he is succeeded by Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter had a marvelous opportunity because he was a Southerner. He was a Democrat. He could have reshaped the Democratic Party. But it turned out, and the sound, I covered that campaign very, very extensively. I was a political reporter for the old National Observer at the time, the Dow Jones newspaper. And I got to know him fairly well, and I was very impressed with some of his thinking. And I think that he was a thoughtful politician. It turned out that once he got into the White House, he was hapless as an executive and as a leader. And so whatever he might have wanted to accomplish, he didn't know how to go about it. His relations with Congress, which was a thoroughly Democratic Congress, were abysmal. So I think even within a year of his presidency, it was pretty clear that he was out to sea. His presidency is a failure.
Is it true that he spent a lot of time trying to decide who had access to the tennis courts at the White House, that was important on his political or his presidential agenda?
Well, I doubt if he spent a lot of time on that after it was reported, because it was reported that he actually wanted to be the one that sort of oversaw the scheduling of who would use the tennis courts at any given time. And once that was written about, it was so embarrassing, I'm sure he didn't. It was also said that, you know, he wanted to have some tax initiatives, and so he took the tax code home at night to read upstairs in the White House. Well, that's not how you try to understand how to run a legislative initiative. Mark Shields, the commentator, had a great term for all this. He said Jimmy Carter gave work a bad name.
Then comes the most unusual president, I think, of the 20th century, unusual in terms of the background, though he had to be sure a career that followed his career as a movie actor for many years. He was indeed governor of California after he ended his movie career, and then he wants to the White House, still astounding many people. There was some wag who said, Reagan is president? No, Jimmy Stewart is president, Reagan is vice president. Yeah. But there we were, Ronald Reagan, two full significant terms.
Yeah, not only significant terms, but he meets that test, the two terms succeeded by his own party, and succeeded by the man that he essentially chose to be his successor.
That's George H.W. Bush.
Yeah. Reagan, he meets also my third criterion, which is changing the political landscape and creating new coalitions and making it possible, therefore, to pass legislation that moves the country out of crisis and into a new time. The crisis, we tend to forget that inflationary and stagflation era with high interest rates and that inflation that was just robbing people of their savings and their earning power and their purchasing power. And Walter Heller, the economist, said that the great inflation is to our time what the Great Depression was in Roosevelt's time. And Reagan, working with Paul Volcker, the chairman of the Fed, who was going to wring this inflation out by putting the country through the ringer, Reagan never took exception to that, but he passed tax cut legislation designed to keep things moving while Volcker was doing that, and it was heralded at the time. It was considered abysmal policy by a lot of liberals, but it worked. And as I say, when it works, when things work, the American people reward you, and they rewarded him with a landslide victory. And then his second term was largely the foreign policy term. He did bring about a very significant tax reform in 1986, but his relations with the Soviets, I think, was absolutely brilliant. And I think he gets the single greatest amount of credit. A lot of credit goes to a lot of people over decades, but he's the man with the single greatest attribution of credit to the winning of the Cold War, in my view.
He handled himself with considerable grace as well. I remember being much impressed by that, and I was at that time only beginning to turn from the left towards the right in terms of my own political persuasion. I think he helped me make the turn.
Mm-hmm. I think he did for a lot of people. Who would have thought? I mean, for one thing, people didn't think that this B-grade, B-movie actor was going to become president. If
yes.
he did become president, he couldn't possibly succeed. But who would have thought that there would be such a thing that he would generate in American politics as what was known as the Reagan Democrats?
Yes, indeed.
I mean, there's certainly no such thing as an Obama Republican today, right? So that's a major political accomplishment to create Reagan mm-hmm. Democrats, to basically bring people into the fold that
yes.
Had not been there before.
That's a very nice point, nicely said. And then we come to his vice president, now elevated to the presidency, George H.W. Bush.
I've never been willing to give George H.W. Bush a great deal of credit for what he did. He's a one-term president. I think the American people saw that he was a decent man. He accomplished some things. But by and large, he was what I call an in-basket president. He had no initiatives. He just wanted to manage the day. Whatever came into his in-basket, mm-hmm. he would deal with, and he would deal with relatively efficiently. But a lot of things were percolating in America that he just wasn't prepared to deal with. And I think that my own view is that he essentially killed Reaganism. He didn't understand, notwithstanding his total loyalty over those 8 years to Reagan, I don't think he and his people, particularly that guy, Richard Darman, who became his budget director, appreciated Reagan or understood the essence of Reagan's political success, and they thought they were going to do it better, and it turned out that they couldn't.
One remembers the debate, the presidential debate, in which he looks at his wristwatch as Bill Clinton and the Texas eccentric, what's his name again? The third candidate who gave the presidency to Clinton by being there and siphoning off a good deal of the Republican vote. Why am I blocking on his name? You know the man I mean.
Yeah, it's contagious because I am too, but I'll come to me in a minute. As soon as I stop thinking about it.
Right. But
Ross Perot.
Ross Perot, of course. And if Ross hears this, please forgive us. You played an interesting and important role. You do agree with me, don't you, that if Perot hadn't been there, probably the first George Bush would have been reelected.
I think that serious third-party or independent party candidates always harm the incumbent because they don't exist unless there's a problem with the incumbency. So, yes, I do believe that.
And so Clinton gets the presidency. An interesting character, to say the least. And what do you make of him?
Well, I write in my book that we have to give Clinton credit for being a good president. He presided over good times. The budget was flush. The country was not facing a lot of military problems overseas. He certainly didn't get us into any military adventures that we couldn't control, unlike his successor. I don't think he was a great president because he sat on his political capital, I think, a little too avidly. He didn't try to move the country in new directions because he was afraid to expend political capital and take risks. But after his first 2 years, which were not a success and which led to his head being handed to him by the Republicans in the 94 elections, we have to say that he presided quite effectively, notwithstanding the scandal and other things that emerged.
Of course, the scandal is the Lewinsky scandal more than anything else. Yeah. So there are also many questions raised, even when he was still down in Little Rock, about his finances and his misuse of them, perhaps. But the Lewinsky scandal put such a stain on the American presidency, partly for its tawdriness, mm-hmm. And the fact that he stood against what was almost an inevitable invitation that he resigned just to go away and hide in shame. The fact that he did not, I suppose, commends him in a way as brave, but I'm not sure that it did us a great deal of good.
Well, he looks terrible in that regard, and it's funny, he took a big hit in terms of how the American people viewed him, but over time, I think the American people kind of accepted him as a kind of charming rogue who presided over reasonably good times.
We've heard already your judgment of the second George Bush. Let me then go forward to the current president of the United States, Barack Obama.
Well, I believe Barack Obama missed a marvelous opportunity to do what I say great presidents do, which and they aren't called upon at any at any time, at all times in the American history to do this, but that is to create new coalitions and new idioms of politics that helps him build force, political force, that he can use to move the country through crisis into a new era, into a new direction. And he had a great opportunity because being the first black president in our history, being a Democrat at a time when the last Republican term was considered to be pretty much a failure, which I believe it was, and being elected at a time when the country really needed some new kind of leadership, not just the same old nostrums, which would then get responded by the same old Republican nostrums, but basically create these new coalitions that we were talking about that Roosevelt did and Reagan did. And he just squandered that opportunity. And so I think that his first term was lackluster, but not so lackluster as to be ineligible for rehire. So he was reelected. I will note that he was reelected by a very relatively narrow margin, 3.6 percentage points, I believe. The only three presidents who were reelected were elected a second time with a margin less than that, and they all had disastrous second terms: Woodrow Wilson, Grover Cleveland, and George W. Bush. And it looks to me like we're seeing the same sort of a thing with Obama. His second term is looking very lackluster, and he's looking rather hapless here.
That suggests that you would probably have to predict that his successor will be the Republican nominee, whoever that is.
Unless he can turn it around and show the American people by the end of his second term that in our system of looking at the incumbent's record, that he deserves to be reelected. But I don't think really that it's likely to happen. It's going to have to be a dramatic turnaround.
Yeah. Well, Robert Murray, I thank you very much for joining us. I've been delighted by this promenade through the recent presidents, and of course your book, Where They Stand, the American Presidents in the Eyes of Voters and Historians, does the same for all of them and does it with great skill and also with much anecdotage that isn't ordinarily available. I'm happy to commend it to all of our listeners and to thank you once again for joining us on this podcast.
It's been a great pleasure for me. Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Thanks again and good night for now. And with that, we'll thank all for listening. Whenever they download the podcast, remember you can do that anytime just by the flick of a button or the press of a key. I think you know how to use your computer or your other instrument as well or better than I do. But we're glad that you're there. Be with you again soon.